From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Players don't bunt much in the playoffs, but there's sure a lot of bunting. Ahead on Only a Game, an MLB playoffs update. Also, the University of South Florida hurries north in the college football polls. The Green Bay Packers aim for 5-0 behind their record-setting quarterback. And a conversation with Jeff Davis, author of Roselle, Czar of the NFL. Also ahead, the defiant riders of Side Saddle.
Well, it's fun, and it's only girls.
You don't have to worry about boys, like, trying to challenge you, like, going, I bet I'm a better rider riding Side Saddle than you.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Fans of the Cleveland Indians, who were afraid after their team clobbered the New York Yankees in Game 1 of their division championship series that it couldn't really be that easy, must really be worried now. The Indians beat the Yankees again yesterday evening. This time it took 11 innings and an RBI single from Travis Hafner to push the Indians past the Yankees in a game that saw players on both teams frustrated by an infestation of gnats. The Indians lead the series 2-0. Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim are hoping that they'll do better in Los Angeles or Anaheim or someplace west of Boston. They lost Game 2 of their division championship series against the Red Sox last night when Boston's Manny Ramirez hit a 3-run home run in the 9th inning to end a game that had been tied since the 5th. The Sox are up 2-0 in that series. In National League playoff action, the Arizona Diamondbacks can eliminate the Chicago Cubs with a win this evening. Those two teams will play in Chicago. The Colorado Rockies, up 2-0 in their series against the Philadelphia Phillies, will host the Phils tonight. The Rockies are 16-1 in their last 17 games. Joining me now to discuss that unlikely run is Troy Rank, who covers the Rockies for the Denver Post. Troy, 16 wins in their last 17 games. Gee, if they could just step it up a little, the Rockies would be right there.
Yeah, it's like nothing else I've covered in sports, from covering everything from high school to college to NFL and everywhere in between. I have never seen a team this hot for this long. The only comparison would be the Broncos team I covered that in 98 started the season at 12-0, but that team was favored, was coming off a Super Bowl. This team was floating around 500 when they have gone on this improbable streak.
Who are the individuals most responsible for this terrific season?
Well, there's two guys in particular that most people are going to know about by the end of this month, and that's Matt Holliday, who's 36 home runs. He led the league in RBIs. He led the league in batting. He's got a real shot to win MVP. But maybe the biggest factor has been their rookie shortstop, Troy Tulowitzki. He's got a lot of Derek Jeter in him, and he's got a shot to win National League Rookie of the Year. He had the greatest offensive season ever by a National League rookie shortstop. But more than that, and a lot of guys lead by example, he leads by personality. I mean, he literally exerts his will on this team, and their manager, Clint Hurdle, described it. It was like he was that special sauce that brought the flavor out in everybody.
The stadium the Rockies play in is about a mile above sea level. The Rockies have a home field advantage like no other in that respect. And now the forecast says there's a chance for snow in the Denver area this weekend. Could this be set up any better for Colorado to move on?
No, I mean, they really couldn't. And yet they are 39-14 in their last 53 home games. I mean, it's a college-like type dominance. So I would be very surprised if they don't win one of these two games. I mean, I'm not guaranteeing a sweep, but given the kind of enthusiasm in this state, I mean, it's in a purple haze right now. Everyone seems to be a Rockies fan. The game Monday night when they won the tiebreaker with the Padres was as loud as I've ever heard a Rockies crowd, and that was for the tiebreaker. Now with a chance to clinch today, I think that this would be it'd be a shock if they didn't escape this weekend with this series being over. I mean, and yeah, you're right. The snow plays into it. The players are comfortable in the cold weather from April games. Everything seems to be pointing and signaling toward the Rockies advancing.
Mike Coolbaugh, a first base coach for one of the farm teams in the Colorado system, was killed when a line drive struck him in the head earlier this season. And this week, the Major League squad voted to award Coolbaugh's pregnant widow a full share of the team's playoff winnings. Have you ever heard of something like that happening with a ball club before?
You know, I've seen it happen, unfortunately, after the death of Darren Williams here with the Broncos, where players donate hundreds of thousands of dollars in his name for a youth center or to his family, or in this case there was a tombstone donation for him. But I've never heard it in this regard where 25 guys were involved. And I can say from being around this team, they really have a camaraderie. They really like the guy next to them, and a lot of them just genuinely want to do the right thing. And it's, you know, in talking to the players about it, it was unanimous. There wasn't a debate. I mean, remember, if they were to go to the World Series and win, the share last year was $362,000. You know, even if they just advanced to the National League Championship Series and lose, that share last year was $124,000. I mean, yeah, they all make great money, but a lot of these guys don't. I mean, they're younger players. So for them to do that, I think it does speak volumes of the type of clubhouse and the type of leadership they have in that room.
The Arizona Diamondbacks are also just one game away from reaching the league championship series. Would an all-expansion championship series between two teams largely unknown on the East Coast spark massive panic in the offices of Fox Sports?
I think it would. I was telling someone that the other day when we were watching the Cubs play the Diamondbacks that as the Rockies obviously got off to this hot start, that I'm sure people in the offices back there at MLB are just praying that the Cubs get in because it would be similar to when, you know, the Pistons played the Spurs in the NBA Finals. It's good baseball. They play the game the right way. There's a lot of great stories, but the reality is they're not sexy primetime drama. People do not know those teams because, unfortunately, on the East Coast, a lot of people have gone to bed when the Rockies are in the second and third inning of their games. I mean, that's just the reality of it. So it would be good for, you know, I'd say maybe Iowa on because they probably know these two teams. But I know for ratings that, yeah, they're not rooting for Diamondbacks-Rockies. I can guarantee you that. I mean, the Rockies understand. The first time they were on national TV this season was Monday, the 163rd game of the season. I mean, this wasn't a team they were going out of their way to publicize.
Well, they're playing as if they enjoyed being on national TV and are looking forward to being on national TV for a couple more weeks.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the players said. They're going to have to talk about us and deal with us if we keep winning.
Troy Rank covers the Colorado Rockies for the Denver Post. Troy, thanks again.
No problem. Anytime.
Neither the Gators nor the Seminoles nor the Hurricanes are Florida's top-ranked college football team this week. That distinction goes to the number 6-ranked University of South Florida Bulls. Bobby O'Brien of member station WUSF in Tampa witnessed the Bulls' victory last week over previously 5th-ranked West Virginia, and she reports on the team's sudden success.
Just north of the batting cages on USF's Tampa campus is an empty patch of land with a few crumbling sidewalks and overgrown grass. It is the birthplace of USF football, where newly hired coach Jim Leavitt made his office in an abandoned trailer, where he personally washed the team jerseys and lit the practice field with the headlights of his coaches' cars.
It's amazing to think that USF can get where Florida can get to a BCS bowl. It almost defies imagination that something like this could happen.
Joey Johnson, a columnist with the Tampa Tribune, has reported on the USF program since 1996.
USF is almost its different animal because nobody has started a program and come this far this quickly. So it's USF, in a way, is almost incomparable to other teams. I mean, the Floridas and the Florida States are the ones we would cover the most, in the Miamis and the... You know, Florida just celebrated its 100th year of football last year. USF is in its 11th year of football.
The Bulls started this season unranked, but have rushed headlong into the national spotlight with their first Big East Conference game against the number 5 West Virginia Mountaineers just over a week ago. Touchdown! The Bulls' 21-13 victory was historic in many ways. It was the first USF sellout at Raymond James Stadium. For the first time ever, USF students camped out overnight to get tickets. And the broadcast was the second highest rated regular season football game ever on ESPN2. Even Tampa Mayor Pam Iorio, an alumnus, joined the stampede. She organized a rally at City Hall September 28th.
We love our Bulls! And we want to show it. So today is Green and Gold Day in the city of Tampa and beyond, even in West Virginia. It's Green and Gold Day.
Yeah!
In attendance at the game were several Bull representatives, including the Orange Bull's Jack Seiler.
This is a program that's on the rise. I think, you know, people in Florida have been paying attention to what's going on. But I think now when you have a national game, you know, Friday night under the lights, sold out crowd, I think the country's going to take notice, and it's a good thing. It's great for the community, it's great for the college, and it's great for college football.
After the game, his hair and shirt still wet from the traditional dousing, Coach Jim Leavitt was asked what the win means to his young program.
I know you want me to take off my shirt and dance and yell and hug and kiss and all that, and I feel good like that, but I'm serious about what I'm saying.
Leavitt admitted that maybe the upset victory hadn't sunk in yet.
The crowd was unbelievable. It was hard to not get too emotional. I was really concerned about that. I was really emotional before the game, and our players were really emotional. They really wanted to win. They really wanted to win. You know, they really wanted to win.
Leavitt is the only head coach the team has ever known. He's recruited players almost exclusively from Florida, competing against the Gators, Seminoles, and Hurricanes for top high school prospects. Leavitt recruits by selling the promise of the team, by offering players an opportunity to be a part of history. It's what brought senior linebacker Ben Moffitt to USF.
And I've said it from my first interview coming out of high school that this is where I wanted to see the program go, in this direction, and this is what I wanted to have, you know, accomplished in my time here.
Moffitt had two interceptions in the West Virginia game and was named Defensive Player of the Week in the Big East. Moffitt and others, like linebacker Bruce Montpierre, reflect their coach's businesslike approach and almost stoic reflection on being ranked number 6 in the nation by AP.
Honestly, I don't feel different from 6, 18, 23, or unranked. I mean, we're still going out there working hard, doing what we have to do. I honestly don't feel a difference.
It's hard to believe that any USF player would feel that way, particularly quarterback Matt Grothy, who after playing before 67,000 last week, was carried off the field by fans. He admits he's looking forward to today's game at Florida Atlantic because their 20,000-seat stadium reminds him of high school.
You know, I miss playing high school football, and I'll miss it every day till the day I die, so it'll be fun getting back into that smaller stadium where it's not as loud and you're just going out there to play football and not working off somebody's energy in the crowd.
According to fan David Mason, who graduated from USF last year, these are the good old days. When he enrolled, USF was still a Division II football team.
Before, you didn't have to fight to get seats. You went, you tailgated, you went to the game. Now it's a whole different atmosphere. People get here 7-8 hours early. It's starting to turn into a football town. We like it.
USF's next home game is October 13th against the University of Central Florida, another young program just an hour or so drive east on Interstate 4. That game is expected to sell out, too. For Only a Game, I'm Bobby O'Brien in Tampa.
It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Go into the chapel.
Recently on Only a Game, we featured a story about a demolition derby in which drivers who divorced each other also smashed their cars into each other. Now Kevin Weaver has demonstrated that a demo derby can also be an appropriate venue for romance, or at least a romantic gesture. Before an event in Mifflinville, Pennsylvania, Mr. Weaver painted a question along the side of his car. Karen Slusser, will you marry me? The car was also decorated with a big stuffed rabbit to advertise Ms. Slusser's rabbit breeding business. In its paws, the stuffed rabbit held a big stuffed ring. Weaver finished third in the demolition derby. Oh, yeah, and Karen Slusser said yes.
Today's a day. We'll say I do, and we'll never
I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, the NFL commissionership of Pete Rozelle. But first, many preseason predictions had Green Bay ranked among the NFL's worst teams. Some openly questioned quarterback Brett Favre's decision to return for his 16th season. But the Packers are currently 4-0, and Favre made NFL history last week. Here to talk about Green Bay's exceptional start and what may lie ahead is Tom Silverstein, who covers the Packers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, welcome to Only a Game.
Very glad to be here, Bill.
You know the team about as well as anybody does, I suppose. So are you surprised by the Packers' 4-0 start?
Yeah, I'm very surprised. I did not see that coming at all. You know, things change in the NFL very quickly, and 4-12 teams can become 12-4 teams in a hurry. But I didn't really see that with the Packers because of how young they were, how few established offensive players they had, and frankly, whether Brett Favre was going to be able to alter his game to account for some of the youth that they have and not try to do everything on his own, as has been the case the last couple of years.
You know, given how well the Packers have started, it's really too bad that the team's fans aren't very loyal and enthusiastic, because it could be a great local story.
Yeah, you know, they might actually be able to whittle the waiting list at Lambeau Field down to, you know, 70,000 maybe.
Selling out is not a problem.
No, that hasn't been a real problem. And, you know, if you would like your children to get on, I would put them on now if they've just been born. So,
after losing some key free agents and suffering through two seasons during which Green Bay failed to make the playoffs at all, many people were calling for Favre's retirement. What did Brett Favre know or believe he knew that prevented him from just riding off across the tundra?
Well, it's funny because he has agonized over this decision whether to retire for, I think it's going on 4 years now. I have maintained, I've covered every single game he's played since he came into Green Bay, and I've maintained that all along that they'll have to drag him off the field, that he may talk about retirement, but, you know, they will literally have to take a hook and grab him through the face mask and take him off the field, because he's such a competitor and he loves the game and he loves, you know, being around the locker room and with the guys. And I just think he physically is still capable of being a very strong and productive player. And that's the part that I think the Packers recognized as well when they asked him back last year.
You were in Minneapolis last Sunday, and you witnessed Favre breaking Dan Marino's record for career touchdown passes. Anything particular and specific stand out from that day for you?
To me, it was classic Favre, because the 40-second play clock was winding down. He decides he's going to call an audible in a place where nobody can hear him because the noise is so loud. And it's almost like a street yard kind of a play. He runs up to the tight end and yells, "Drag it." You know, and then he runs back to the shotgun formation. They snap the ball. The tight end runs a different route. Boom, he hits the 16-yard touchdown to Greg Jennings. And it's just like classic street ball. He just went up to the guy and told him, you know, go to the street light.
The Packers host arch-rival Chicago tomorrow, and that's got to be a delicious prospect for Packers fans. Their guys are 4-0, and the Bears are 1-3.
Has a great possibility to be a huge letdown game for the Packers. Mm. You know, as much as you would think that they've got the Bears where they want them finally, they've actually lost their last three games to Chicago at home. And the Bears, this is kind of their make-or-break game, I think, for the season. And they're going to give the Packers everything they've got. And it wouldn't surprise me if they did come through on this one. You know, this is the rivalry game. This is the game that, you know, it used to be in Green Bay that, okay, if you lost every game, just beat the Bears and everything would be okay.
Well, I know it's a long season, and a lot can happen in the remaining 12 games that the Packers have, but can the team and its fans actually be thinking about, dare I say it, Arizona in February 2008?
That is asking a lot. You know, I think so far the fans have taken a very much wait-and-see attitude, which, you know, for Packer fans, they are behind their team, but they're also somewhat critics. You know, the base of their fans are not all bandwagon jumpers. They have a base that really does understand the game. And then there's the bandwagoners who kind of jump on as they do, as they are successful. And I would say there's some skepticism right now as to whether they're really a legit 4-0 team. They haven't been able to run the ball at all. They really haven't even tried. They've just really been relying on Favre. But people here, if they're winning, everything's good.
Tom Silverstein covers the Green Bay Packers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it was my pleasure.
Love pro football or hate it, nobody can deny that the National Football League has become a monstrously successful conglomeration of sport and entertainment. Pete Rozelle may have been more responsible for that development than any other individual. To some extent, he is still the commissioner against whom all other sports executives are measured. In a new book, Rozelle, Czar of the NFL, Jeff Davis presents the story of Pete Rozelle's life and his achievements. Jeff Davis joins me now from NPR Chicago Bureau. Mr. Davis, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Pete Rozelle became commissioner of the National Football League in 1960. What sort of shape was the league in at that time?
I think it's fair to say that the league was on the move because it had gained a real great notice in 1958 with a sudden death overtime game between the Baltimore Colts and the New York Giants. A large television audience on NBC that saw a back-and-forth thriller. And Madison Avenue took cognizance of this and really started pushing it. Baseball was caught in a flux. The Brooklyn Dodgers and New York Giants had moved to California, to San Francisco for the Giants and Los Angeles for the Dodgers. Football was in a great position to make the move.
You wrote that one of Pete Rozelle's aims was, quote, to knock baseball out of the catbird seat as the preeminent sport. And elsewhere, you wrote that he wanted to make, quote, all the other sports oleoacts and trailers. I'm not entirely sure what that means, but was his idea that one pro sport could succeed only at the expense of the others?
Well, I don't think just at the expense of the others. He just wanted his to be bigger than anything else. And, of course, oleo acts were the old in-between song and dances in the vaudeville days when a couple of guys in the striped coats and the straw hats came out to fill the time while the main stars got ready for their next event.
So he wanted his league to be the big stars, obviously.
He did. He wanted to make stars out of the players, and one of the ways he did it was through NFL films. He made the game human with those close-up shots, with those sounds on the field, with the grit on a snowy day and muddy day. He used all this as a way to create a fan base. He wanted to have football on the mind of people 52 weeks a year.
Pete Rozelle had a potential crisis on his hands in 1962 and 63 after he learned that Paul Hornung and Alex Karras, both very high-profile players, had been betting on games. Alex Karras told you that Commissioner Rozelle paid him off to serve as the scapegoat in that affair. To what extent, if any, is Alex Karras correct?
I have to believe what he said. He wrote that in a book, and he told me that, too. Karras hung around a group of people who were heavily involved with the Teamsters Union, Jimmy Hoffa's operation in Detroit, as Hornung was cavorting with a lot of the Chicago mob. In fact, a couple of Karras's characters were later named as suspects in Hoffa's disappearance. So you understand this was not a bunch of Sunday school teachers that he was messing with. He hired a lawyer that was a Teamsters retainee, and the lawyer went to Rozelle and just told him, look, you're going to have to get my man back in there or we're going to bring you down. He threatened to do it. And about a year had passed, so Rozelle figured it was time to do it anyway. He didn't want to get that thing into the courts, and their agreement obviously was not to talk about it because Karras didn't talk about that for many, many years. Yeah. Hornung, on the other hand, was under the orders of Vince Lombardi to keep his nose clean and stay out of trouble and stay away from the tracks. He did all that, and stayed away all the years he played football until many years later. I love the story he told about going to a racetrack at Del Mar after Roselle retired, and there he is, and they're talking about betting on the horses. So there you go.
Yeah, but Roselle would always make somebody else go to the window with his money. He didn't want anybody to see him actually placing a bet.
That's correct. But he did love the horses. I love the story that William Knack told about Roselle being at the Belmont Park the afternoon that Secretariat won his third leg of the Triple Crown. And he said, all of a sudden, Roselle said, I looked down and I was standing on top of a table and I have no idea how I got up there.
On several occasions during Pete Roselle's watch, the owners tried to break the players' union. In 1987, they went so far as to field teams of replacement players. To what extent was the commissioner responsible for saving the league or at least reestablishing its credibility after that misadventure?
Well, he had gotten caught in a real bad squeeze. A lot of things were coming together and adversely against him in the 80s. He had dealings with Al Davis, who was the owner of the Oakland Raiders and the major domo there, who defied him and moved the team down from Oakland to Los Angeles after the Rams moved to Anaheim and left the Coliseum open. And he won in court. Roselle spent more time in court. His daughter, Anne Marie, said, Dad was in court all the time. It was just, it was eating at him.
And not a place that he particularly enjoyed being.
No, and then the labor situation, he had never dealt with a guy like Tough Ed Garvey from Madison, Wisconsin, the lawyer who ran that association, and he made life miserable for Pete. It was not a gentlemanly negotiating session. This was hard-nosed labor, and that wasn't his best game. And they hired a guy who'd been a strikebreaker named Jack Donlin to run the show for them. And they took over, really, that function of the league, which made Roselle as a negotiator powerless. And he understood this. Finally, when his time came, he went to Paul Tagliabue and said, you've got to get to Gene Upshaw, who by then was running the players, and you've got to make peace with him. The game can't have it any other way. So even as he's leaving office, his influence carried through, and he led his successor to have a better situation.
Gene Klein, the former owner of the San Diego Chargers and one of Pete Roselle's closest friends, said that he didn't think the ex-commissioner attended a single NFL game after he retired. Were you surprised to learn that?
Yes, I was. But I think it's kind of like so many people who work so intensely. He devoted his whole life to that league. I think it just burned him out. He was only 63 when he stepped down. And he only had about a year or two of half-decent good health. His health already started to fail by the time he left. His daughter said that when she thought that he may have had a small stroke or a series of them. And Tom Flores, who was Al Davis's coach, remarked that he thought Pete seemed to be slipping. Mm-hmm. He didn't look good at the end. He had big circles under his eyes. And his wife, Carrie, said, Pete gets up in the middle of the night, paces the room and smokes a pack of cigarettes as he makes notes. Boy, that's not a way to live. I think that he just didn't want to have any more to do with it, and he didn't want to travel. He preferred to stay at home. And however, he did have a room full of television sets, so he took on the league through TV.
Jeff Davis is the author of Roselle, Czar of the NFL, published by McGraw-Hill. He joined me from NPR Chicago Bureau. Mr. Davis, thank you very much for speaking with me.
What a pleasure this has been to talk to you, and I really appreciate the time you've given me.
You're listening to Only a Game. Our program 2 weeks ago featured Only a Game senior producer Gary Wallach's story about a group of men in Montana who have two things in common, cancer and a love of fishing. Under the auspices of Real Recovery, the men discussed together what they were facing, caught and released some trout, and did some bonding. Bill Caldwell, a WBUR listener, wrote to say he felt the story was, quote, simply one of the best things I have ever heard anywhere, anytime. I have to admit that when the story ended, I had tears in my eyes. Adam Shorn of Cambridge, Massachusetts, wrote, you really hit a home run with the story on Real Recovery. As a cancer survivor, I found the segment poignant and moving. I can't thank you enough for running that story. Batya Bauman, who hears the program on WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts, felt otherwise. I find it very offensive that you promote such a violent and cruel activity as fly fishing, she wrote. From Barre, Massachusetts, Stephen Rashik and his family wrote, we are appalled that you promoted fly fishing. We have decided to stop listening to shows on WBUR and switch to another station because of this matter. My conversation last week with Glenn Stout about his new book, The Cubs, generated some email, or rather the song we played at the end of that conversation did. The song was Cubs in Five by the Mountain Goats. Let me suggest that next week you play a stanza from Here Come the Cubs by the Beach Boys, wrote Jim Crist, who hears the program on WYPR in Baltimore. Another Cubs fan, Will Forrest, who listens to Only a Game on Vermont Public Radio, had another suggestion, a pretty energetic one. How can you do a story on the Cubs and not play a dying Cubs fan's last request by Steve Goodman, he wanted to know. I'm amazed by the number of baseball fans who've never heard this song. Please listen and play it for your audience as soon as possible. Well, Mr. Forrest, we have heard a dying Cub fan's last request. We've even played it more than once. It's great. But in order to keep ourselves entertained, we've had to find alternatives. You know, we can't go with the same song every time we mention the Cubs. What the heck.
Do they still play the blues in Chicago?
You can submit your suggestions, musical and otherwise, to us through our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
To the home of the brave, the land of the free and the doormat of the National League.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In its 53rd year, the Galway International Oyster Festival produced a champion from Sweden. Restaurateur Hasse Johannesson opened 30 oysters in just 2 minutes and 41 seconds, thus assuming, in his fourth try, the title of champion oyster opener. The secret is not just good timing, but in the clean presentation, as if you would serve it in a restaurant, said the triumphant champ, and he was right. Competitors who shucked oysters included traces of blood, evidence that the shuckers had sliced themselves as well as the oysters, were penalized for same. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Getting Sideways on a Horse. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
It pains me to announce this, Charlie, but Cubs lose! Cubs lose!
Ah! Cubbies lose! Pulling Victor Zambrano after 85 pitches in Game 1 isn't working out the way Lou Piniella thought it would. I have a problem with this series in that I need this to go 4 or 5 games so I can familiarize myself with anybody who plays for the Arizona Diamondbacks, since I don't know anything about these guys.
That's part of the fun of these playoffs. I don't have anything against the Phillies, Charlie, but I think we should point out that the Rockies, who own a 2-0 lead over Philadelphia at this point, have given us, various reasons to root for them.
Yeah, in addition to being, like, the best baseball story of the year, they've also taken it upon themselves to vote a playoff share to Amanda Coolbaugh, the widow of the coach for the Tulsa Drillers, Mike Coolbaugh, who was killed by a line drive this summer. So if you need a reason to root for the Rockies, besides the fact they've played the last month of the season, like the last two reels of The Natural, there it is.
By the way, how did you celebrate Colorado Rockies Purple Wednesday?
I actually didn't, actually, because I find it offensive to my objectivity to wear a color just because a baseball team wants me to.
After years of insisting that she had never taken steroids, track and field's Marion Jones admitted that she had done so before the Sydney Games back in 2000. What's the impact likely to be beyond Marion Jones herself?
Well, I think anybody who's in the camp of drug test them all, and if we don't like the results, we just won't believe them anyway, got a big boost by this one, because this is another person who never tested positive. But it's amazing how a stint in federal prison will clarify your memory of past events.
This week, a spokesman for the People for Ethical Treatment of Animals said that Michael Vick had recently completed an 8-hour course in empathy and animal protection. Too little, too late?
Much too little and too late. It's not going to get Michael Vick out of jail. It's probably good that he took this. I have no intention, not having arrived at the studio today in a turnip truck, of believing he did this voluntarily. This is obviously some deal he made with some prosecutor or another.
Turnip truck, I think. Miles Brand, the president of the NCAA, is smiling this week. Why is that?
Well, apparently the graduation rates are going up in men's Division I basketball, baseball, and football. The overall rate in all sports is 77%, but the rates for the three poorest performing groups of athletes, namely three of the sports that make the NCAA 60% of its operating budget, are ticking up a little bit, so Miles is happy.
Does this mean coaches aren't doing their jobs?
No, I suspect it means professors aren't doing their jobs, but we won't go into that.
Here's a sports headline that suggests to me that more bad times are in store for the New York Knicks. Isaiah back to work after losing Case. What do you think?
He now has 11 million reasons to treat his female employees better than he did. It's very odd that this decision would come down in the week where Clarence Thomas is touting his autobiography where he defends himself against the Anita Hill charges of sexual harassment with another guy, and another authority figure named Thomas gets whacked upside the head by a court. I'm amazed he still has a job. Obviously, James Dolan, the white boy who can't sing the blues, who owns Madison Square Garden, has Isaiah's back on this one. They're going to have to write an awfully big check, and this guy simply should not have a job anymore.
I guess the only explanation is because the Knicks have been so successful on the basketball.
Exactly court. Right. They can't get rid of Isaiah because of what he's done with that roster.
Reggie Theus, the new coach of the Sacramento Kings, gathered his players this week and spoke of trust. And then he told them that they would have a midnight curfew before road games and that there would be no cell phone use on the team bus. So will trust be forthcoming?
He trusts them to obey rules that you wouldn't give your 12th grader on a school trip to Manhattan. You know, I understand what he's doing. But this is one of those things that indicates to me that Reggie Theus is not long for this job. Because sooner or later, A, these players will start lying to him and break these rules, and B, then it will become about his authority, and then it will become about why he's not the coach anymore.
Speaking of trust, the Golden State Warriors are apparently an extremely trusting organization. That NBA team has named Steven Jackson as their captain.
Well, that's because he's gotten that nasty thing about criminal recklessness, you know, where he fired the gun outside the strip club in Indianapolis. He's got that behind him, having pleaded guilty to it, to a felony count. So I think once you've cleared up the gun-toting outside the strip joint part, the way to the captainship is clear.
Captains should be armed. I don't want to get too local here, Charlie, but with the Red Sox in the postseason, the Patriots undefeated, Celtic fans all excited about the acquisition of Kevin Garnett, and the Revolution winning soccer's U.S. Open Cup on Wednesday night, what must it feel like to be a Boston Bruin?
I don't know. I'll go see if I can find the team and let you know. The Bruins are hapless. The Bruins are hopeless. The Bruins have the one unsolvable problem for any sports fan, and that is a bad owner.
And who knew that among his many other talents and interests, New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady was also a passionate movie critic?
He's passionate, comma, and a movie critic. Apparently, they were flying out to Cincinnati in the in-flight movie, on a flight to Cincinnati, by the way, which is very nice. The Al Pacino film The Recruit was on it, which also stars Tom Brady's ex-girlfriend and mother of his child, Bridget Moynihan. Apparently, there were suddenly unexplained technical difficulties, and they couldn't watch the movie. Who knew?
Meanwhile, hockey, eh?
Oh, boy.
You want to make some picks?
What fun, yes. I predict Gary Bettman will do something to bungle the image of his league. I don't know. I mean, everybody seems to be very high on the Rangers this year. I note the Senators have re-signed Danny Heatley. They're still a really good team. there seems to be a little interest nationally in two nations, in the Calgary Flames. I think the team that wins the most games in the Stanley Cup Finals will likely take the Stanley Cup home.
Well, you heard it here first. Charlie, thanks to your willingness to share your expertise, I have known for some time that NASCAR is popular throughout the U.S., but why didn't you tell me about the extent to which the sport has gone international?
Dario Franchitti and Juan Pablo Montoya, who are CART racers, have gotten together at Chip Ganassi Racing's with a guy named Felix Sabates, and now they have there is an international NASCAR
team.
There
you go. In another story of steroid use, we find athletes using banned substances to increase their weight. Some of them now weigh well over 2,000 pounds. Do you find this alarming?
Bull riding, son! Bull riding, and it's not the guys riding the bulls that are being shot full of this. Do you want to be the guy that tests them? I mean, honestly. Do you want to gather the samples?
Italian third division soccer team AC Ancona has new ownership, and I guess they'll probably never lose again.
The Italian Bishops Conference has bought a controlling stake in AC Ancona to bring more morality into football. The story on the Wire says that the Vatican aims to introduce an ethical code which will punish Ancona's players for any foul play. Now, this is great because they're doing almost instantly to their soccer team what it took them 2,000 years to do for their clergy, which is excellent.
And finally, Charlie, grits eating has a new world champion. His name is Pat Bertoletti. How much grits did he have to eat to win the $4,000 first prize?
How much grit can a grit eater eat? Well, he ate 21 pounds of grit. Tss, 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 tss. Right? Grits, not grit. 21 pounds. You can hang wallpaper on this guy's esophagus right now.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. In fact, he wrote almost all of this week's edition himself. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Hey, get right for soul food.
To experience Only a Game's magical web world, please visit onlyagame.org.
Are those penny yams?
The headquarters of the U.S. equestrian team sits on 100 acres in Gladstone, New Jersey. The site is host to top-level competitions, including Grand Prix events and Olympic trials. And it recently hosted Side Saddle Weekend. Diane Toomey attended the two-day event, which included everything from serious competitions to serious dress-up, and she has our report.
A small crowd watches as eight riders canter around a large outdoor ring at the U.S. Equestrian Team headquarters. The athletes sit ramrod straight in their navy jackets. These riders are competing on a course that includes eight jumps, each 3 feet high. Sounds difficult? It is. But this is Side Saddle Weekend. So now imagine riding this course the way these women are today, sitting sideways in skirts.
Ladies, would you line up in this order, head to tail, please? 153, followed by 130.
And then imagine having that skirt lifted.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
My name is Peter, lift your skirt up, is that okay? Thank you, ma'am.
Well, at least he asked permission. Once the skirt is lifted, just a tad, the judge inspects the rider's tack. This particular competition is a reenactment of 19th century fox hunting protocol. A rider must dress in a dark navy habit and wear a top hat and veil, and she must carry a couple of items needed on a long hunt. A sandwich in a metal case, and a small bottle of her favorite beverage. Seems that sherry was the Gatorade of the 1890s.
And it is a black cherry sherry.
Oh, wow.
It's been in there for a while. It may be a little more potent than normal.
Oh, yeah.
Jeannie Whitehead has been riding a side for 2 decades and is something of a side saddle historian.
I personally tend to blame Coco Chanel in the 1920s and 30s for the demise of side saddle because she was a very fashionable woman. Everyone copied her, and she rode her horse astride.
She admits the style was on its way out before Coco's time. As early as the 1870s, there were discussions about whether women should ride like men. The arguments against went like this.
That it's unattractive, it's unbecoming a lady, that she's not physically properly conformed to straddle a horse.
And the style did just about die out by the 1970s. That's when, as a young girl, Whitehead went to a horse show.
And walking around on the grounds, there was a woman riding side saddle. And I didn't know side saddle from anything at the time. I just saw this woman on this big, beautiful horse, and she looked so elegant and perfect and just had this aura about her, and she was so graceful. I said, that's what I want to do.
Number 94. This is Jeannie Whitehead in Tally.
Later in the weekend, Whitehead competes in a riding competition in which ladies wear costumes of side saddle eras gone by. She's dressed in an 1858-style brown habit, suitably sedate.
By 1858, the fashion magazines discouraged the excessive ornamentation and fripperies seen in the riding habits of previous decades. Riders were urged to moderate their skirt and veil lengths and have less, shall we say, bling.
Before she goes into the ring, Whitehead tells me about her costume, and it's clear she's gone above and beyond.
I have on a full skirt, a petticoat, a corset, a chemise, and a pair of open crotch drawers.
Did you take the longest to get ready out of anyone today?
Quite possibly.
But Whitehead is a thoroughly modern woman who doesn't view side saddle as anachronistic. She even works at the Smithsonian's Air and Space Museum. Like the 80 or so riders here this weekend, Whitehead sees the style as an elegant way to show off horse and rider. Also present this weekend, side saddle instructors like this one.
People say, what do I do for a living? And I say, my normal comment is that I'm a ladies' man.
Roger Philpott has been teaching side saddle for 35 years. The 70-year-old is in from Warwickshire, England this weekend to share his expertise with U.S. riders like Carla Petros.
Now, I just want you to ask the horse to go forward now into trot, okay? So you're going to put your inside leg on and your stick, and you're going to push with your seat and just move your weight forward a little bit. You push with your seat, turn.
When it comes to communicating with the horse, a riding stick takes the place of the right leg, since only the left leg is in a stirrup. So why aren't these women constantly falling off? Well, that's because of two thick pieces of leather called pummels. Used properly, they allow the rider to form a scissor grip on the saddle with her thighs. Even though her legs are on one side, a rider's hip should face front with her weight centered.
Just put your leg and stick on a little bit. More. That. Now we got a horse. Well done.
Philpott was once called upon to work on the Queen's side saddle and observed she was a rider in near-perfect balance.
The thing that I noticed more than anything else was the actual wear on the saddle was the seat bones were perfectly straight for the front of a saddle, which is very rare, which showed that you had a rider of very high ability.
For those lacking the British royal family's resources, side saddle can be difficult to afford. The last British company to make side saddles went out of business in the 1950s. So if you want a decent one, you can spend up to $5,000 to have one custom made in Austria, or you can buy vintage. It's estimated that 90% of side saddles in use today were made in England between 1910 and 1940. And the clothes can be pricey too. In the equestrian team headquarters rotunda, vendors are selling vintage riding clothes, including a $400 1908 skirt with pockets for those saddle pummels.
Two of the habits came out of a Connecticut estate, and the one is dated 1908, and we would assume that they're...
Historical reenactments are a big part of side saddle, and it's how a lot of women get into the sport. That's what happened to Janet Brown, who lives near Richmond, Virginia. This weekend, she's competing in the historical costume division as a Confederate officer's wife. But she didn't start out wanting to ride side saddle. She was just looking for a fight.
I first got into side saddle about 13 or 14 years ago. I started Civil War reenacting, and at the time, they did not allow women to ride into battle.
So Janet proposed a compromise. How about riding separate from the troops as an officer's wife? To be historically accurate, she'd have to ride side saddle.
And they said, you can't do side saddle. And I said, oh, yes, I can. And I basically got the whole reenacting world to change to allow women to ride side saddle and then also to allow them to ride into battle because I fought so hard to do it.
11-year-old Emma Hartley and 12-year-old Sarah Bean were among the youngest riders here. They also feel a sense of defiance while riding side saddle.
Well, it's fun, and it's only girls.
You don't have to worry about boys, like, trying to challenge you, like, going, I bet I'm a better rider riding side saddle than you.
Both Emma and Sarah competed this weekend, but they didn't place. However, Jeannie Whited's attention to detail, underwear and all, paid off. She took second place in the costume competition. For Only a Game, I'm Diane Toomey in Gladstone, New Jersey.
All right, ladies, the class is closed. You are being judged. All walk, please. All walk.
My friend, got treated like just ain't treated like it do. Got treated like you oughta treat her like the lady.
Got treated like
the best you can do.
Got treated like
you gotta treat her like a lady.
She giving you
all the can see. You know what I mean.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Julian Saporiti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from side saddle rider Jeannie Whited, who recalls a star athlete from one of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales.
The wife of Bath is usually illustrated as straddling her horse. She was also considered something of a racy woman.
Now that's an entertaining astride. I mean aside. See, that's a funny side saddle humor there, and take it from me, there's no other kind. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
I'm gonna treat her like a lady. So affectionately, I'm gonna treat her like a lady. She's giving to me, Lord, look and think. You know what I mean. Oh, you gotta treat her like a lady.
Gotta treat her like
the best you can do.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.